is from Sherman Oaks, California, or that's what it says on his warrants. You know, he moves fast. I don't know what town he lives in exactly, he told me last night. But from the Los Angeles area, Scott R.
My name's Scott Redmond. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Good morning. Thank you so much for inviting me to your party. I'm having a great time. And I want to congratulate all the book winners. I hope you never win again. It's like being voted most attractive man on your cell block, kind of. It's someone already took my water. I want to ask you a favor today. Don't take anything that I'm doing as an indictment of what you're doing. I've been asked to come tell my story, so that's what I'm going to do. And some of you might listen to my story and say, how does he stay sober for 10 minutes? And I'm convinced this is why God made more than one of us, so that we'd have different experiences and we could show a different quality of love to the new people coming in. So please, I absolutely don't know how you should be doing this thing. And I know how I've been doing it, and how I've been doing it, thank God, changes all the time. It's such a pleasure for me to be in New York. I grew up in New York. I grew up in the Bronx to a long line of idiots. And I was just in upstate New York. One of my sons is in school up there, and I just had an incredible 3 days with him, and now on. I've got great friends here today. If you're new, I'm sure you're thrilled for me. I know I was so happy for the people having a good time when I got here. I just couldn't hear enough about it, you know? The new house and the new family and the new car. And I'd sit in my seat and I'd think, maybe you'll go home and maybe your house will blow up. And we'll see how spiritual you are next week. But with me, I said this to myself. You know, people in AA would talk to me, and I'd grin, and I'd nod, and just pray that their face would burst into flame. You know, just, isn't it bad that I'm here? Isn't it bad enough I'm here in Alcoholics Anonymous that I'm here? I grew up in the Bronx. She's got to be here with the witness protection program. She's just clapping to me. To a very troubled family, very crazy, disturbed group. My wife never believed me about them until she met them. And my mom threw an engagement party for us, and my Aunt Rose came and wore her wig backwards. And it had a bun on it. So the bun was kind of bouncing off her forehead all night. And it was not a mistake. It was a look she was going for. I did not have alcoholism when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I caught alcoholism in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I did not know what it was. If you had asked me what alcoholism was when I came in, I wouldn't have been able to answer the question. But there were a bunch of reasons why I wasn't an alcoholic. I had been in psychotherapy for 18 years. I was going to be dead, but I was going to understand it. And I'm not putting therapy down. Therapy's great stuff. It says on page 133 of our book, if you need a doctor, go get one. Boy, that's unclear. There's a puzzle. but my colossal mistake is I was trying to treat my alcoholism with psychotherapy, which is like showing up at a gunfight with a knife, you know, once a week and just getting these colossal ass poundings. I also couldn't have been an alcoholic because I'm Jewish. And Jews don't drink because it might dull the pain. And you don't want to squander any agony opportunity. One of the first of many people who have saved my life in AA was this guy at my first home group. I was a couple of days sober, and he raised his hand. He said, my name's John. He said, I'm an ex-Catholic, which means I don't believe in God, and I'm therefore positive God is going to come kill my ass for feeling that way. And I said, I'm sitting next to him. I'm going to go, because that's exactly the way I felt. So I did not have alcoholism when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I caught it here. I love newcomer plans. I collect them. And because, you see, I had a lot of mental problems. And if alcoholism was a mental problem, I would be in good shape because I had really good therapy. You know, it's a physical problem. I have little or no control over how much I take in once I start, and I can't moderate. If you're special and a drug addict, try some controlled crack smoking. You know, just fill your mouth up with crack smoke and say, I'm not in a mood, and blow it out. And we'll make you president. And but seriously, if you're a drug addict, welcome to AA. If you're a crack monster, welcome to AA. I like to welcome all the tweakers here today. I like it. Love you guys. If you've ever licked all the features off your own face, welcome to AA. And I don't care what you have. I'm serious. Just catch alcoholism. We'd love to give it to you. You know? I have a new favorite newcomer plan, and it just came to me through a buddy a couple of months ago. This buddy of mine calls me. He says, he's working with this guy. Guy's got a couple of weeks, and he sees a bruise on the guy's chest. He said, what happened? And the guy opens his shirt. He's got these huge purple bruises all over his torso. And my friend said, what happened to you? And the guy said, When I hit my bottom a couple of weeks ago, I was going to kill myself, so I drank a bottle of vodka. I stole a vial of nitroglycerin tablets from a heart patient. And he said, I took all the nitroglycerin and then started smashing my body into the wall trying to blow myself up. I feel like I can sit down now. I really feel like we're done. Now, if his nickname isn't Boom Boom or Nitro, then his home group sucks, as far as I'm concerned. Now, if you're new, you're going to hear some wacky stuff about alcoholism. And some of it makes sense to me, and some of it doesn't. The stuff that doesn't make any sense to me, I've never found in the Big Book. And yet, it still is meaningful to some people. Again, I know there's a reason why God made more than one of us. Different things resonate for different people. I've heard that alcoholics don't like change. Don't like it. I don't like change. I don't like. But I love change. I love it. I've never heard anyone get to a podium and say, oh, I hit the lottery. I'm having sex with identical twins. It's killing me. This change is ripping me up. But my favorite is that alcoholics are above average intelligence. I have only heard this at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I have never heard it any place else, anywhere else. Just ask Boom Boom. And he'll tell you how smart we are. I didn't know that I had a mental problem. I didn't know that I had a physical problem. And I didn't know that this mental problem kept talking me into taking a drink I couldn't stop taking. And then I developed this cancer of the soul, the spiritual tapeworm that ate me up from the inside and left me empty and insane and alone. If I had realized the gravity of my problem, I don't know that I could have fit the pain in my head. I don't know that I could have stayed here. And I started my journey to AA very young. I started drinking very young. I was a kid, and I didn't want to be an alcoholic, so I overcame my alcohol problem with marijuana. I'd like to welcome all the pot smokers here today. You remember WOW, right? They're clapping, and they actually don't remember why they started clapping. No short-term memory at all. Where else do you go where a drug gets a round of applause? Marijuana, hey! You remember WOW, right? Wow. And right after WOW usually came, what? What? Wow, what? Wow, what? Wow, what? Wow, what? Watching a pot smoker is like watching a dog try to run on linoleum. There's a lot of activity, but no movement. They can't get a claw in a rug, you know? Overcame my marijuana problem with pills, and I conquered pills with cocaine. Cocaine's an excellent drug. It's particularly good for sex if you enjoy sex from the Neolithic period. If your last date looked like the first scene of a CSI episode, you... And I kicked that gall-darn cocaine with heroin. Heroin's a very dark, complicated, artistic drug. Then you cross a line and become a vomiting pig. And alcohol was on the table every day. But I wasn't an alcoholic. I was in my early 20s, and I had shot some dope. I was hitchhiking down from the Bronx to Manhattan. My aunt and uncle picked me up, and my father had had a massive stroke. I was taken to the hospital, and I couldn't show up for my old man the night he died. The curtain was down, and I was an animal, a pig. I had holes in my arms. I couldn't even go and give him a kiss and touch his cheek and watch him take his light into another room because I had so rearranged my life to accommodate alcoholism. I had become so uncivilized by that time. I had unplugged myself from life one resentment at a time, one fear at a time, one episode of sexual misconduct at a time. I didn't know what that was. I didn't know that that was the landscape, the architecture of the soul sickness that had plucked me beyond the possibility of being helped by well-meaning clergy, a loving family, children that adored me, wonderful career, and a lot of dreams. Because if you got in between me and the drink, you vanished or you became something less than human. You either disappeared or you became a papier-mâché figure because I was going to walk through you and I was going to walk around you. But I was going to get to where I needed to get. I had to do some fast work because it was one of those moments where I just hit a wall and the horror was too great for me that night, the terrible night my father died. And I couldn't be that guy. I couldn't be that pig that showed up at the hospital and just couldn't be there. And I figured out as quick as I could, it was heroin and needles, and all I had to do is never put a needle in my arm again and I wouldn't be that guy. I'd be another guy, but I wouldn't be that guy. And I didn't. I didn't put a needle in my arm again. Not for 13 years. Shortly after that, I was acting in a Broadway play. And a new usherette walked in with long brown hair. And I took one look at her. I didn't even say hello to her. I walked into the dressing room and got up on a chair and announced to the male members of this company that if anybody talked to the new usherette with long brown hair, that I'd break all the bones in their hands and feet. And we celebrated 31 years of marriage last June. In part because we've never wanted to get divorced at the same time. You know, there's timing involved here. If you got a couple of years in, you know what I'm talking about. And we had a great time. Great time living in New York in her early 20s. Nancy was working at a big concert hall, and I was acting on Broadway, and we had a great time. And then after a while, she became troubled. She started becoming really quite mentally ill from prolonged exposure to me. And I came home one day. We had these 32-ounce iced tea tumblers in the house, and I popped a cork on a bottle of wine. I emptied the entire bottle of wine into one of these tumblers, and I turn around, and my wife was giving me her pre-Al-Anon rat face. And I said, "What?" And she said, "What are you doing?" And I looked at her in the eye, and I said, "I'm having a glass of wine." Can a man have a glass of wine in his own home? We became so sick that at one point a guy lent us his car, and we sold his car. I will never forget this guy's voice on the phone as long as I live. He said, "You sold my car?" That's like house sitting for someone, and they come back, and you're in escrow. You're like showing the house, you know? Got a little flag out front. The alcoholic life becomes the only normal life. We didn't have money. I didn't want to borrow money. I said, my wife, we didn't have rent. I said, look, we're not going to be punk, irresponsible kids anymore. We're going to draw a line in the sand. Let's sell the car. And my wife, with tears in her eyes, said, let's do. And I still have that thinking. And that's why I do more in AA at 21 years than I did when I was new. On top of the fact that I like it, you know. 2 years ago, I had to go into the hospital and get, they told me I needed they were going to put an 8-inch needle in my side to do this biopsy. And I went, what? And they said, okay, we'll work it out. We'll give you something to relax you. And I said, great. Talk to the sponsor. I'm okay for relaxation. And I'm 19 years sober. I go to the hospital, and the lady checks me in. And I said, I was told I was going to get relaxed for this. And she said, they do it in there. So I go in. The guy takes my clothes, and I said, do you do the relaxing? Because I was told I would relax. Guy says, no, the guy will be in. So guy comes in, he puts a line in my arm, and I went, you're the relaxing guy, because, you know, I got an IV. He said, they do that downstairs. So they take me downstairs, they put me on a table, they say, turn this way, turn that way. I said, I'm not turning anyway. I was promised relaxation. I'm not I'm not relaxed. I've got clearance for this, and I'm not relaxed. So they go, a lot of rolling eyes, and they get the doctor. The doctor comes in and he says, I can't give you anything. When I have that needle in you, you have to respond or I could nick a vital organ. I said, 11 people have told me that I'm going to get relaxed. And he said, I'll tell you why. I said, why? He said, because you look insane. And no one's been willing to say no to you. So they just keep going. So I still have the thinking. Nancy and I had our first son, Micah, and he was really welcomed into our community. We had surrounded by friends and flowers and phone calls. And 2 years and 9 months later, when our son Jesse was born, we had become so isolated by the disease of alcoholism, no one came to the hospital, there were no phone calls, no flowers. The ice around our heart had become so thick. We pressed ourselves on the people that loved us like a thumb upon a bruise, and it was too hard. It was too hard to be with us. And the baby was sick and went up to neonatal intensive care, and Nancy was all alone in this hospital. And, you know, I don't really believe there's a better way to go to a hospital than that maternity ward when things are happening and the community's there and people are excited. And it was the opposite end of the pole. It brought up to us, it mirrored to us the misery of our isolation. You know? And a doctor called me that night and said, your child's in neonatal intensive care, your wife is in really bad shape. Where are you? And I said, you know, I can't find anybody to watch my two-year-old son. And this doctor, who I had never met before, in a big metropolitan hospital, said, well, you know what, my husband's home, and you can take your son to my house, and my husband will watch him for you, so you can come be with your family. And I said, no. I had no way to accept this woman's kindness. I think it was another night where I hit the wall, and I took in the gravity of the misery of my situation. It was the terrible night my son was born. What an awful thing to say and feel. But it was the terrible night my son was born. And little were we to know that that was going to continue for 3 more years. You'd think it was going to be bad enough, but it got worse for 3 years. And in 1985, on April 22nd, my sons were 6 and 3. They had become, their backs were broken by alcoholism. They were so disrupted by being frightened all the time, they could barely put small tasks together. There was nothing organically wrong with them. They were just scared all the time. And I didn't know. I didn't know about the warped lives of blameless wives and children. I didn't know that the hardwiring of this alcoholic thinking becomes terribly and miserably imprinted in the ones that are exposed to it. So my kids, like so many other active alcoholic homes that I've had the honor of being associated with in my years of sobriety, my children were either pointlessly aggressive en route to a goal that never got achieved because just something would happen. Something would happen. Or they would just throw in the towel and say, what's the use anyhow? My sons have received 21 appropriate birthday gifts that they wanted on the day of their birthday. Not once in 21 years have they received the day after radioactive guilt gift, you know, from the only joint that would still take a hot check from me, you know. Here's some drywall, boys. the kids are loving the drywall right now. Shortly before I got sober, a Christian family moved in next to us, and their children used to talk about God in a very open, lovely way. And my older son, Michael, when he was 5 at that time, came to me and said, Dad, is there anything such as God? And I looked into the eyes of my perfect, adorable baby boy, and I lied to him. I said, no. I thought I was saving him some skin so he wouldn't have to be played like a sap or a sucker. I thought I was giving him the real existential party line, something every 5-year-old is famished for. And what I did was I not only gave him the worst information I think you could possibly give a child, which is basically, you know, when you're alone and it's dark and you can't go to sleep and you're scared, tough, because that's all there is. I mean, that's really in essence what you're telling the baby. And I lied to him. He should have been taken away from me. I can't imagine a worse thing to do to a child. And I stood in the face of all this immutable law, all this poetry, all of this perfection, and said, no, it's not there. But I didn't have the connective tissue. My alcoholism, no matter what happened, would go below the horizon. It would stop presenting itself as a real piece of business, and I would act without reason, without explanation, without sense. It would stop presenting itself as a real problem. Now, sometimes I could keep it above the horizon if something fabulous happened or something horrible happened. But it's on my own juice, and eventually it's going to sink below. The strange mental twist is going to become dominant, and I'm going to act without reason and without sense. And there was nothing I can do about it. And on April 22nd, 1985, I crossed the line that I swore I would never cross again. I put a needle in my arm. I called my therapist of record in my my 18th year of psychotherapy. I told him what I had done, and he said to me, I didn't know this until I came into AA and read the literature. He said to me the same thing that Carl Jung told the man who 12-stepped Bill Wilson. He said, there's absolutely nothing that can be done for you. And I said, what are you talking about? He said, I can't help you. The only thing I can suggest is you attend a meeting is that we have you institutionalized. And then he said the thing that Carl Jung couldn't say. He said, or you attend a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous or Alcoholics Anonymous. Carl Jung did, of course, talk to Roland Hazard about the fact that spiritual experience has saved people in the past, but he didn't feel it. You know, he was trying to bring about such a change in Roland Hazard, but had failed. Why I went to the AA meeting is a complete mystery to me. I don't know. Why I didn't go to the mental institution? Again, I don't know. I'm a guy who loves dental surgery, you know. Normal people don't like dental surgery. I like dental surgery. I like general anesthetic. Normal people don't like general anesthetic, but I know something about general anesthetic. When they hit you with it, they say, count backwards from 100. And you go, 100, 99. I love 99. Why I went to that Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, I can't tell you, but I did. I took one step into this room called Unit A in the San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles. I took one look around and I said to myself, oh my God, how did I wind up in Alcoholics Anonymous? How? This is beyond lame. This is beyond church, beyond synagogue. This is some plateau of lameness I never even imagined was available to me. And the room looked like it was the product of 200 years of inbreeding, you know, as far as I was concerned. There were like identical twins carving their initials on each other's feet in the back of the room, or so it seemed to me. And everything was a miracle. I'm a miracle. You're a miracle. It's a miracle. 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 The furniture and coffee, they're miracles. It's a miracle. Oh, my God. And I'm waiting for the Jew hunt to start, right? I know that's going to happen. Come on, Jaime. Strap these antlers on. Always wanted to run a big buck Jew. Then the AA unsolicited information guy, he got me at the end of the meeting. You know him, right? Do I want what you've got? No. No, but thanks for spitting on me, Clyde. I really appreciate it. I'll come back next week. We'll hook a rug. Do I bring my own bib overalls? Do you issue me a pair? What's the deal, you know? I hated everything about it. I went back to that meeting every morning for a year. And it's a mystery to me why I did. The only reason I can imagine is I was out of plans. If you're new here, I pray for you that you're out of plans. If you are new and you have a plan, it's probably a beaut. Don't use your plan. Grab one of us after the meeting and tell us your plan. We want to know the plan. Oh, my God. And my wife reached out to the Allen on family groups and got her thing going. And one of the things that was very disturbing and injurious to me when I came in is my wife reached out to Al-Anon and found an incredible thing there and got an incredible sponsor who's still a big part of my life named Ruby M. And I would go to AA meetings sometimes and I would hear people tell jokes about Al-Anon. I'm not talking about good-natured jokes. We tell good-natured jokes about AA. I'm talking about mean-spirited and hurtful jokes. And until I stuck around here long enough to find out that the people who were doing it had no functioning knowledge of the work done in the Al-Anon family groups. If they did, they could never talk about it that way. It would be like going someplace and hearing people tell distorted, misinformed stories about AA. I know, I'd say, you couldn't possibly know what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous if you would deprecate it that way. You don't know, my heart would fall out of me. And yet it's tolerated sometimes in AA. And until I stuck around long enough to find out that these people were just being mean, ignorant people, although I judge no man. Because I'm too spiritually developed. I would sit in my seat and say, and I was very confused by it. I'd say, because I was very proud of my wife. And I'd say, isn't this like the family recovery, isn't it? All the literature talks about it. Isn't this a good thing? Yeah, it is. And if you are involved in a family recovery, God bless you. I love you. I hope that you blow on the embers of what you've got until you really become fire starters. You know, God bless you. And, that's good. You told Nancy and I to not get involved in our first year, and we didn't. I had nothing to bring to my marriage whatsoever. I would scream until she shut up. I didn't know how to fight. Or I would cry until she shut up. I've always enjoyed the tyranny of helplessness. It's always been a very good tool for me. And I'm a loomer. I like to loom. I like to get a light behind me so she's in a shadow. It's like total eclipse of the Jew if I get her like right in there, right? And if I can get a scream, a cry, and a loom into one fight, that's a hat trick. That's it's the Scott Redmond couples workshop right now. I don't feel like a grown man my whole life. I stood next to guys 10 years younger than me and said, I wonder what it's like to be a grown man. That's a crappy way to live. You're a dollar short and a day late every day. And I didn't know it was because I didn't act like a grown man. Grown men clean up after themselves. Grown men do a lot of stuff that I wasn't doing. I used to think that a certain amount of housework should equal a certain amount of sex. That there should be conversion tables on the back of cleaning products of housework to sex. And I know that there's a guy out there who's smelling marketing right now. Right now? Some smart guy. And I started cleaning the house for God. You know, boy, I'm sure glad you didn't tell me that my first day. If this works, you'll clean your house for God. Really. And I stuck around for 6 months. I knew I was going to drink because I had seen the AA deal. People came in and did the work and changed. People came in, didn't do the work, didn't change, got sick, got sicker, got to the podium, shared their gifts with us, and shared their ass right out the door. So I knew I was going to drink. And my wife had gotten this thing going in Al-Anon that was very attractive to me, although I didn't think it was for us because we were too broken up. And I asked a guy to sponsor me at 6 months. He was a great guy. And he made sure I'd done some reading from the big book of AA and invited me over to his house and read chapter 5 to me. And on the way through, he took me through the first two steps. We reached step 3 and got on our knees and said a prayer, which I felt was embarrassing and unnecessary, but I did it anyway. And then he went back and he gave me instructions on how to do a fourth step from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did step 6 and 7 for the first time after 5, because I took 3 months. I did my inventory. I read it to him. And after doing 6 and 7 at 9 months, I wrote my, which has really become the centerpiece of my relationship with my God. And I wrote up my 8-step list. And I try to share this anytime I talk, because it's simply the best reading of step 8 I've ever heard. I was a couple of weeks sober at this men's meeting that was to become my home group. And there was a hospital group there, and there was a guy named Nino. I'd never seen him before, and I've never seen him since. This was 21 years ago. He had a heavy New York accent. He had hospital plastic on his wrist, and he had never read Chapter 5 before. And he was reading it for the first time. And he got up to Step 8, and he said, "Made a list of all those we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all." Jesus Christ! And he looked out into the room as if to say, "Have you seen this? Do you know what the hell is in here?" It was so beautiful because it's the only thing I saw. I didn't see anything else. Not that money. I would not have taken that much money if I knew I had to give it back, you know? You think I'm a moron? If you're new, don't worry about it. It's 8 steps from where you are anyway. And 8's not even the annoying one. It's 9, really. The give it back step is the really annoying one. And I wrote up my 8-step list, and I didn't know what I was going to do about my wife and my sons and my dad. I just didn't know. And some suggestions were made to me about writing letters and visiting the grave, and it just didn't give me any relief. And I was blessed with a sponsor who wouldn't play God with me and just wouldn't tell me what to do. He just said, "I don't know what you're good. Do your job in AA. Let's see what happens. Let's see what happens. You know, I don't know what's going to happen, but do your job. You've got your 8-step list. Check it out occasionally, and let's see what goes on." So, and he said, "Why don't you address your inventory as your spiritual task?" So I had to, like, go into school and do some very embarrassing stuff. I had to advocate for my kids. I was embarrassed with my children because they were so troubled. And sometimes when a kid is very smart and doesn't achieve, understandably, some teachers can get very angry because especially when kids were as disturbed as our family, it seems like the kid is willfully not utilizing a resource that maybe some other children who are very, you know, industrious would utilize. So this one teacher says to me, "You know, sometimes I want to grab him and shake him." And I said, "He's all shook. We need help. Will you help us?" And no one ever said no, ever. The boys were tested. They needed special ed. And the teacher there said, look, why don't we get him into music and sports and see if that'll help the small motor stuff, you know? So Jesse wanted to play drums, and I didn't have any dough. But my kid expressed an interest in something. I went to a music store, and I bought him a drum pad, which is a piece of wood with a piece of rubber and a couple of sticks. I had backed my kid up, and I went back to my home group, and I told the guys what I had done. And I'll tell you why I told them, because they were really interested in our family. They were really rooting for us. It wasn't a matter of bragging. It was a matter of reporting, and they wanted the report. And within a couple of months, the AA drum set showed up at our house. We had a lot of burnout drummers in our group at that time. So guys are showing up with these Megadeth drums, you know. Dude. And Jesse had this drum set that when he sat behind, he disappeared. You couldn't even see him. And some years ago, I got to go to the House of Blues on the Sunset Strip in L.A. and watch my sons play the House of Blues and burn the dump down. Burn it down. Playing hip-hop music to this room packed with 800-900 kids, and over to the side is this group of weeping middle-aged alcoholics, you know. The kids are going, what is with the crying old people, man? And they look like they've been around the block, you know. And got him in a little league. Spent some dope dollars on a mitt. Get your kid the right pair of jeans. I'm not talking about a lot of money. I'm talking about a few dollars, you know. And my son, the first time I went to the little league game, my wife comes to the game, and there's all the parents in the stands, and there's me alone in the sun, pissed off, you know, going up and down three hat sizes, just psycho, you know. I'm here, I'm doing my job, I'm here, I'm here, I'm here. And the kids are going, look, Mr. Redmond's going to blow up, man. Wow, that's unbelievable. And it took me a couple of years for the voices to diminish in volume and number to go and just be with the people in the stands. Just be at my sobriety station. That's my sobriety station in the stands. And I was there the day that my son received, I believe, one of the greatest compliments a human being can receive. He was intentionally walked. Now, if you're not a baseball fan, that means they're scared of you and want to get to the weenie behind you. And it's pretty cool. And he didn't want to jump up and down and be a geek. So he laid his bat down. He trotted up the first baseline, and he shot a look at me. I'm at my sobriety station just this much, just a little bit, not too much. It's the old man. You don't want to spoil him. And I could have missed the whole thing. And I'm not telling you that my son got intentionally walked because I was sober. I'm telling you that I was there because I was sober. And I've been with enough guys who have been drunk on their kid's birthday again, that have been too drunk to go to the meeting for their kid again, to know the value of that. I know who put me at my sobriety station and kept me there. And our family made a new beginning. We were so sick. We had these rules for our kids in the house. Our kids weren't allowed to curse, eat sugar, or watch TV. So, you know, in the old days, my wife would give them a healthy breakfast and put them in the car with me, Dr. Death, and say, hope you live. You've had your granola. You can die with your father now. And her sponsor, Ruby, would bring the boys over, give them a big bowl of M&Ms, turn the Love Boat on the TV, and sit them down. I'm going to curse twice. I'm sorry. And she'd say, boys, if you say thanks, you get more shit. And my sons are 28 and 25, and they have said to me recently, Dad, if you say thanks, you get more shit. And her husband, Milton M., who some of you probably know, they've been living in Vancouver for a while, and Milton was 7 years sober at that time, and he called my sons over one day. It's my last bad word. Blame Alan. He asked me to come talk. Milton called the boys over. They were little boys. And he bent down and he said, boys, your parents don't know shit. And they went, oh, my God, we suspected, but now it's been confirmed. This is fantastic.
There's chocolate and cursing in television. This is like great.
And she lightened us up. She pried open our jaws and they spit life back in us and they lightened us up, light and polite. They didn't, never told us we were wrong. They just brought out the M&Ms. I was working in the show business industry for a long time. When I got sober, I had this ghostwriting job, which was kind of perfect for me at that point in my life because I really had become a ghost. And I was doing that job in my first year, and I was kind of becoming a spiritual Goliath at that time. I was taking on sponsees and stuff. And I had this overture made to me by a situation comedy to be the staff director for this sitcom. And that's a really good job, and it's a lot of dough. And I really felt that the guys I sponsor would just so benefit from me getting this job. And I directed one episode, and I didn't get the job. And I almost drank. And I went to my sponsor, and I told him I was humiliated. And he said to me, well, I guess you have the show business God. And I said, what? He said, well, what keeps you sober? I said, God. He said, okay, God keeps you sober. You didn't get a job, and you almost drank, a show business job. So I guess you have the show business God, and he has abandoned you utterly. Now, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard people talking about God getting them jobs, God getting them into relationships, God getting them parking spaces. And I went, whoa, not the parking space God. Wow. And if you have the parking space God, and he gives you space, pass it on. My family and I were really badly injured in the Northridge earthquake, the last big quake in L.A. Our house got smashed up. I got a bad physical injury. And shortly after the quake, we were at an AA function out of town, and a woman who used to live in Los Angeles came up to me and said, oh, I'm so glad that God got us out of L.A. before the quake. And I said, oh, so he likes you. He likes you, but we're crap, but he likes you. And she said, I guess he just felt you had some lessons to learn. I'm out of here. I can't possibly live in a world where I don't want to stay sober in a world where I would see God's intentional hand in the suffering of people. Where God's saying, get him, get the Redmond boy, get him. No evacuation plan for you, Jew boy, get him. Get him, turn his wife to salt, kill his goat, put a finger in his eye, get him, smote his ass, smote anyone he talks to, smote them all. We'll figure it out later. It's like God is some deranged game show host, you know? You're due for a rash, it's boils for you, let's key your car. And there's a reason, you'll figure it out later. Oy. I sponsored this guy named Mike. Mike was a great guy. And he's one of those guys that comes into your home group looking like he was just like shot out of a cannon. I mean, just destroyed, crackhead, alcoholic destroyed. And I used to pick him up every week before the home group and drive him over there. And he started making a beginning. He's one of those guys that the group gets behind. That's a love child for the group, you know. And he made a beginning and he was a couple of years sober, and he came to me. I picked him up for the group one night, and he said, you know, I met a girl a couple of weeks ago, and she's pregnant, and we want to get married and have the baby. What do you think? And I took a deep breath, and I know the guy. I know the guy's not a sexual predator. I had no resentment against the guy or fear, and I did what I was taught to do in AA. I took a deep breath, and I said, what do you want me to do? If you don't want to have the baby, I'll help you. If you want to have the baby, I'll help you. What do you want me to do? And I think he gulped. I think he was kind of expecting a little more than that. And he said, I'd like you to be the best man at my wedding, and I want to have the baby. And that's what I did. And the group, we had a baby shower for him, and the group got really excited about this child. And the baby was born, and the baby was terribly sick. She was at death's door. She was rushed to the hospital that could help her. I'm not going to go into the details. It's pretty gruesome. She had really one of the most invasive things that could happen to a child, and we didn't know if she was going to make it. And the call went out to the AA community that we're part of, and the drunks started showing up, you know, for this baby. And if you, to go to neonatal intensive care, you've got to be a member of the family. And after a while, the nurses at the nurses' station just said, "Don't stop to lie, just go in." You know, because 6'6" Ethiopian men, small Asian women. You know, it's just. And when the baby was home after 16 days, the call, because the call went out for blood. Now, a lot of us can't give blood because we are ex-hypes or we got fresh ink, one of the two, you know. And, but we go just to get pissed off that they won't take our blood. And and after they were at home, like for weeks, the hospital calls my buddy and goes, "Tell them to stop. They're like dropping blood off in jars, man." It's like, you know. Enough's enough. Now, did that marriage make it? No. What a shock. People get divorced, you know. Those two people have done an incredible job raising that child together in love. What if I had said no? What if I had played God with that guy? You know, we have to turn our critical thinking over to another human being when we get here. We have to. And with luck and with industry, we will find people who know the big truth here, that you cannot then hold on to that critical thinking, covet it, and use it to guide that person's life as God. You can't. That the people, I believe, who are doing this successfully are taking that and shepherding it to this power, this incredible power, you know. And I had to work to find that because I found a couple of people when I came in that tried to take advantage of me financially and stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I could have used that for my ticket out, but I knew better. Something inside me knew better. And so my sponsor said to me, and the funny thing is, the last thing I want to say about Mike and his baby is that in that hospital, she laid down, little Cassidy laid down next to a baby named Rachel Wang. The reason why I remember Rachel is Rachel didn't make it. Rachel passed on. She took her light into another room, and her family was there, as Cassidy's AA family was there. My God doesn't kill children. My God is pure love, mine. My God expects me to do my job in AA if it's to show a newcomer how to stay sober through the annihilation of a child or through the prosperity of a child. But my God's not killing babies. Mine. This is just my story. I couldn't live in that world, you know. My God expects me to do my job in AA if it's to show a guy how to live in a refrigerator box or live in a house on the hill. My God's not putting people. He's just not involved in real estate. It's just not. It's not my deal. So that morning when I went to my sponsor and I told him what I had done and I wrote the inventory, I'm resentful at Scott for almost drinking. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. Now, God's got a magic wand. He comes and touches me on the head. What is it in me that if God would remove, the resentment would be gone? Because I don't just hate stuff. I hate stuff so that when I wake up, I water the hatred like a little flower. I want to make sure it's developing and that it's okay. The worst thing is when I forget to hate something, you know, and a guy goes, "Hi." And I go, "Hi. Oh, I hate him. Why did I do that? Now I'm going to have to redouble my snubbing just to get back to where I was, you know?" I hate so that when my head hits the pillow, it becomes a rotisserie. It eats my brain and my heart and turns my life black. It throws me out of my own life. So he said, "When you do 6 and 7 on this, you better ask God what you're going to have to do to stay sober." And I did 6 and 7 that day after reading the inventory. I said, "Pop, take it. You got show business. I'll do anything you want for a living. Anything. Just keep me sober." And within 3 months, I was working as a cook on a catering truck. And I looked up to God and I said, "I didn't mean this. We've had a grotesque misunderstanding. This wasn't even on the long list. I don't even know where the hell you came up with this." Now, in Los Angeles, when they make a TV show or a movie, they hire a caterer. Caterer follows the crew around and makes food for them, and you make a lot of dough. It's Teamster dough. It's a vehicle on a movie set. But I'm Scott Redmond. And the first movie that I catered, the executive producer and star of the movie was a guy who I had worked with in the business. And he stuck his head on the truck that morning, And he said, can I have a burrito? Scott? And I turned around and I said, what's happening, babe? And he said, is this your truck? I said, no, but it's my spatula. And I called my sponsor and I said, oh, we're getting the gift now. It's beautiful. And he said, sounds like you've got a resentment. I'm resentful at Scott for working on a kitchen truck. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. A five-bagger for sure. What is it in me that if God would remove? I'm ungrateful. I'm impatient. I'm playing God. I'm not trusting in God. I'm a mind reader. You know, mind reading, I think, has been the most troublesome, one of the most troublesome defects for me in and out of sobriety. I think I know what people are thinking, and they're never thinking anything good. They're never. My wife has said to me, you're not a mind reader, you're barely a mind user. Mean woman. And that's the list I had to take to my higher power and work that 10-step and show up and show them and give them a dime for their nickel. And I thought my sons and I would get close on Oscar buffing night, you know, the night where we buff my awards. And the fact is my son Jesse wanted to learn how to cook, and I taught him how to cook, and we're still doing that together. Wherever he's been at school, he calls me, and I talk him through a sauce. That's not the way I would have had it. And I wound up serving people who had been my assistant directors and stage managers on TV shows I had directed, actors who I had directed in shows, and I'd come back to my home group every week with a new tale of humiliation, and the guys would just go, ha, ha, ha. And I got to help some guys who thought they had fallen from a height when they came into AA, and they hadn't reached the top rung, which is Child of God, and when you reach that, there's no place to fall from. And I had this friend named Paul who felt he had fallen from a height, and he used to say this prayer. He'd say, God, I'm willing to do anything you want for a living, but please don't let it be as bad as what you did to Scott. I was so glad to help him out, you know. And I'd been cooking for about 3 years. I'd learned how to be a good chef and a good dad and a good husband. And this overture was made to me by a company called Ketchum Public Relations. It was a big comedy writing job, and I felt at this point, after all I had been through, that if I got this job, it would be so good for my sponsees. It would just be such a help to them. Because they had seen me suffer, and now they would see me prosper thusly. And I did a videotape for these guys, and I went nuts before I even found out about the job. My brain blew up. I wrote about it. I read it to my sponsor. And I was cool. And shortly after that, I get a call from Ketchum saying I did not get the job, and I was good. And then I got a call from my catering company to cater some commercials, and I jump into the truck and get over there, and I get the call sheet, which gives you all the information about the shoot. And I see on the call sheet that the commercials are for Ketchum Public Relations. So I'm feeding them now. Now I'm feeding them. And I look at the end of the truck, and there's a guy videotaping me. I said, what are you doing? He said, we're taping the making of the commercial. He's taping my humiliation. And he's going to go back to New York and show them this, and they're going to go, is that Scott Redmond with the meatloaf? Oh, that poor son of a bitch. Can I have one of those glasses of water? Thank you so much. So I called my sponsor, and I said, we're getting the gift now. We're really getting the gift now. It's a miracle. It's just a miracle, miracle, miracle. It's a big miracle. And he said to me, I guess God had enough writers and needed a few cooks today. And then he said, you know, Scott, you told God you wanted to work for Ketchum, and you forgot to tell him what you wanted to do. If you're new here, I want to welcome you to AA. I want to tell you that I have a lot of friends here, and I have new friends. I have friends that I've made since I got to the podium and started talking. And we get excited when we see each other, and a connection gets formed. And here's the crazy idea I had, the crazy lie. The bad idea that I had is that if you take us out of that equation, the connection disappears. It's the face and the breath of God. It's the connective tissue of Alcoholics Anonymous. Wouldn't it be nice if a spiritual experience was enough? But it's not. If I'm not part of a spiritual community that helps shepherd that spiritual experience, encourage it, blow on the embers of it, I'm a lost man. And eventually it'll be turned in again. So I think we hear that over and over again. A home group, a fellowship, a sisterhood, a connection. Those were my sober brothers and sisters. And I think for me it's gone wrong in AA when I've mistaken fellowship for friendship. Friendship quite often comes with a lot of attachment and a lot of stuff. Fellowship never does. It's a pure spiritual relationship. And I've done things in my life that I've become attached to. I don't know why I went to the AA meeting. I don't know why I stayed. These are mysteries that I believe the big book of AA. I believe St. Thomas. I believe the mystics, that to know God is to not know God, that no one can fully comprehend or define that power which is God. And every time I try to ascribe an intention and a personality, I make it this big. I cut the ring on myself. And for a while, I had a good, healthy fear of getting drunk. I did not want to, and I was willing to do anything to not. And I'm not so scared anymore, so I've got more oxygen in my life. And I've been able to do what the 11th step says to do, which is to turn out. I think the big book of AA should be the gateway to all the books. I've never had outside help in Alcoholics Anonymous, and yet I've gone to other 12-step programs. I've gone to therapy. I've done spiritual practices. I've never done any of these instead of AA. I've done all of them because of AA. And I feel energized and enervated. And the incredible thing, if you're new, is my alcoholism has not gone below the horizon, not once in 21 years. It has stayed above the horizon as a real piece of business, because if it's not a real piece of business, it's a complaint. I drank again. How did it happen again? I'll stop after the sixth one. What's the use anyway? It's a complaint. And the stuff that remains a complaint in sobriety has been the stuff that has caused me suffering and I've had to take a look at and I've had to do stuff about. I've had problems in sobriety. No, really. I know there are people that haven't, and I'm not being sarcastic. I'm happy for them. I am not amongst their numbers. I've had a lot of problems with sobriety, in sobriety. And I've had to do stuff about it because I want the whole thing. I want the whole thing. And if you're new, I'm sure you want the whole thing too. If you're new, I want to tell you that the good news is that our problem mainly rests in our mind. Alcoholics Anonymous is the only text about recovery from a fatal illness that I know of that contains the sentence, "We absolutely insist on enjoying life." There's no book about malaria that says malaria is a hoot. You'll love it. You'll meet other people with malaria. Then you'll meet people who just caught malaria. It doesn't get any better than that. Alcoholics Anonymous is the only disease I know of where the recovery leaves the sufferer in better condition than they were in before they contracted the disease. And the bad news is our problem mainly rests in our mind. Just ask Boom Boom. When I was a year sober, I started sponsoring a guy named Roland. I still sponsor him. I've sponsored him for 20 years. And he used to call my house every night, and he'd say, "Scott, it's Roly. I'm sober. I love you. Good night." And he'd hang the phone up. When I was 6 years sober, 5 years after that, my son Micah came to me. And he said, "Dad, you know, I should tell you that when I was a little boy, I couldn't fall asleep until I heard Roland's voice on the machine. And when I heard Roland's voice on the machine, I could go to bed. I think that he was so scared that often he would stay up till he passed out." This is the baby who I tried to rip God out of his hands. And you guys came in over the machine and you tucked him in every night. At 19, he was babysitting for a couple on the program. And this guy said to him, "What do you think of your dad talking in AA?" And Micah said, "I'm not a member. I'm happy for him, you know." He said, "All I can tell you is since I'm a very, very little boy, The men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon have taken very, very good care of me, and never once has any of them demanded that I believe what they believe. Wow, look at you. What an extraordinary thing, especially in this world so rife with spiritual propriety and bullying, of using spiritual tools as spiritual weapons. What an extraordinary testimony for Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new here, I want to urge you as much as I possibly can to take this thing as seriously as you possibly can and go out there and have the time of your life. Welcome to AA. Welcome home. Thanks so much for having me.